This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 12th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up on today's programme...
Our fight against Daesh that carried out this attack will continue with determination. We will not take a step back in our fight against Daesh. Our resolve will continue in our fight against all terrorist organisations.
Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu vows to punish those responsible for the terrorist attack that killed at least 10 people in Istanbul today. My guests Isabel Hilton and Michael Binion will give us their thoughts on this and the day's other top stories. As the flow of refugees into Europe continues to increase, Austria has announced it will crack down on economic migrants to balance immigration values, as they put it. We'll look at this and other measures being put in place to deal with the ongoing crisis. Then we turn our attention to Syria, as Russian President Vladimir Putin has called for a new constitution as a crucial first step into solving the civil war. And finally, we ask, what are China's Hollywood aspirations? That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton and Michael Binion. Isabel Hilton is the editor of China Dialogue, and Michael Binion is a foreign affairs specialist for The Times. Isabel and Michael, welcome to you both. We start today's programme in Turkey, where at least 10 people have died after a suicide bomb attack close to the historic Blue Mosque. It is suspected that a Syrian national, a member of ISIS, was behind the attack, at least that's according to the Turkish government. Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu has vowed to find and punish those linked to the bomber and to continue with the fight against so-called Islamic State. Michael Binion, this is not just... an attack on Turkey. The fact that at least 9 people killed are thought to be German nationals suggests that it is an attack on Germany too.
Well, I don't know that they knew that there were going to be German nationals around in the square where the bomb was detonated. I think they probably knew there would be Western tourists. And so it's an attack on Turkey's economic lifeline. Well, Turkey's got plenty else, but tourism is an important resource, particularly in Istanbul. And if you damage a tourist site, then you really ruin the industry, as we've seen in Egypt. So that was clearly one of the considerations. And Istanbul being very much in the focus of world attention, it's a way of drawing attention to the fact that ISIS is determined to get Turkey just as they've got other places.
And Isabel, you know, this comes after last year where there were 2 elections in Turkey, a lot of political upheaval where there had been a lot of fighting in Kurdish areas. But also, of course, there was that horrendous attack in Ankara of the HDP's, of one of the Turkish opposition party's rallies, which killed more than 100 people. Turkey really has a problem with ISIS at the moment, doesn't it?
Turkey does have a problem with ISIS at the moment, and it does. It's quite ironic because if you remember last year, there was a certain amount of grumbling that Turkey was being at least offering tacit support to ISIS by not policing its own border very closely, by allowing people to cross over, recruits to ISIS to cross over into Syria. And certainly if that was the policy, there's been a fair bit of blowback. It hasn't bought it any immunity at all. I mean, even I think on this blast, which as you say is the third and actually not the biggest, but still strategically important because of where it was, Erdogan didn't give it a lot of attention in his speech. He was, I think, still more concerned about the fighting in southeast Turkey, which is pretty severe at the moment, with his own Kurdish population. And Turkey does seem to be beset on all sides. And it's one of the many complications of this multi-layered war of all against all, that, you know, he's use the cover, if you like, of the general mayhem in the area to relaunch an assault on the Kurds, while the Kurds are emerging as the United States' best friend in Syria and indeed in Iraq, the most reliable on-the-ground troops against the militants. So it becomes, you know, by the day more confused and complicated.
And Michael Binion, Turkey's battle with ISIS has been... And certainly until very recently, even perhaps still right now, doesn't seem to be as important to the Turkish government as its fight against the Kurdish people, both inside and outside its own borders.
Well, indeed. And that has been, to many people in the West, certainly, a scandal. People have felt that Turkey has almost gratuitously launched an attack on the Kurds. And in fact, they used the pretext of a bomb attack by ISIS at a rally where more than 30 people were killed as a way of suddenly saying that there were Kurdish elements to it, or rather, Kurds protested that they weren't being protected. And then the government had a go at the Kurds, and then the whole thing escalated. And in fact, that was before the last Turkish election. People said it was an opportunistic and quite cynical ploy by the government to try to turn around the feeling in the country that against the Kurds and show that the ruling AK party was in fact the most patriotic and the most nationalist party there was, and pointing the finger at the Kurds as being the cause of destabilization. Still, people are still asking whether Turkey is really, really opposed to ISIS. There are still questions about whether they are policing that border and whether there isn't some sort of secret support. And to what extent the Syrian is actually a member of this particular terrorist group, or in fact could have been a Syrian Kurd, it could have been anyone. We still don't know. They found bits of the body, but do they know who he is and what his loyalties were?
On that issue of the border, Isabel, it's more than 500 miles long. It's not straight. It's not necessarily the easiest of borders to police, even if Turkey actually wanted to. And as you both suggested, there have been suggestions at times that they have been more than willing to, at the very least, turn a blind eye to who may or may not be crossing that border. But is it easy for us to sit here in a Western capital where, you know, we don't have a porous 500-mile border, a long border with Syria, and say, well, come on, you should be doing better than this?
That's a perfectly fair point. And even in our island nation, we do appear to let in the odd terrorist. There was a suspect in the Belgian attacks who was discovered to have visited Britain despite being on an international wanted list. But I think the concern has been partly that the authorities were slow to respond to requests from international requests to look for, pick up people, monitor people. It is a long border, but nevertheless, I think that it's a second order problem for Turkey, and the first order problem is the Kurds. It's even that isn't straightforward, because the Kurds in Iraq actually have been supportive of Turkey at a time when Turkey is rapidly losing friends in the neighbourhood. So it's not always true that all Turks are against all Kurds or all Kurds are against Turkey. And I think that one of the most interesting things that will develop as a result of the general breakdown of order in the region is that the Kurds, the position of the Kurds, has to be on the table when everyone sits down to talk about what happens, because this touches, as you know, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey very directly. And I think that to have a proposition of a peace deal when we get there, even in Syria, it can't be done without a serious consideration of the Kurds.
On that issue of the Kurds, Michael, obviously since the beginning of the Iraq war, Iraqi Kurdistan has had a level of autonomy and has also essentially been the beacon for the rest of Kurdistan for how a Kurdish nation could be. In Syria, we're seeing that the beginnings of a sort of a Kurdish enclave are sort of the sort of borders are almost there. When you look at the situation in Turkey, just 2 years ago, there were peace talks between the PKK and the Turkish government. Do you think that that Erdogan can be persuaded to go back to the table, and that we might actually see the beginnings of a Kurdish state across at least three nations begin to appear?
Well, I rather agree with Isabel that that in the end has got to be on the table, because we have had in northern Iraq effectively a de facto Kurdish state, which is something that has been denied the Kurds ever since the First World War, which had been their hopes after the end of the Ottoman Empire that they would form a state of their own. And there were even promises of such a thing, and it never came to pass. And now in northern Iraq, they have actually set up quite an effective self-governed state that has been relatively prosperous, relatively peaceful, and has been a beacon for Western investment. It's got, of course, an oil industry, and actually has had a lot of dealings with Turkey, selling their oil directly to Turkey. Now, I think the Turks have taken fright at the idea that this could not only be a Kurdish state in northern Iraq, but it would attract the remnants of Syria, the Kurdish bits of Syria, add that on, and then it might broaden its horizons and think about setting up a broader Kurdistan that would include parts of eastern Turkey. And that, of course, is anathema. They do not want to have any bits of Turkey included in a de facto new state. So I think that the Turks have taken fright at the idea. They have still got reasonable relations with Iraqi Kurdistan, and they are trading with them, and they are buying a lot of oil from them, and it's important. But they are very complex in their thinking about what to do about the Kurds.
And yet, as well, there were peace talks with the Turkish Kurds.
Oh, indeed. And there was a ceasefire which lasted for quite a long time. And I think the fact that it's broken down is deeply regrettable. I agree with Michael that in the long term, there are three countries who are concerned about the thought of a united Kurdistan emerging. But I do think that there's an intermediate step. And a number of analysts argue that a lot of the difficulties that arise in Iraq, in Syria, and in Iran comes from an overly strong centralized state, which is intolerant of the very substantial minorities that all these countries have. So, you know, if the Shia are on top, they persecute the Sunni, or the Sunni feel at least that they're persecuted, and vice versa. And the Kurds give an example of what can be done with a constitution, which, you know, certainly in Iraq was forced upon Iraq, but nevertheless was rather a positive example that if you have more autonomous self-governing, you know, devolution, if you like, provincial units, it can be a peacemaker rather than a source of division. It's also not true that all Kurds are the same. And so that certainly in the first instance, I don't think that you would see a rush to a united Kurdistan from the populations of those three countries. But what you might hope for is that in each of those three centralized states, that a devolution could bring, you know, a more peaceful settlement, not only for the Kurds, but for other minorities within those states.
On that point, Michael, it's quite interesting. When you talk to Kurds, they say a lot of Kurds do now say, well, look, the dream of a united Kurdistan is not something I'll see in my lifetime. And relatively young people will say that as well. But that the idea, perhaps, one day of a federation of four individual Kurdish states, one day, possibly, might not be 1,000 years away.
Well, indeed. And I suppose you've got historical examples in Europe. Think of Italians, for example, or Germans, who always felt they were Italians or Germans. The notion of being Italian or being German was there for hundreds of years, but they didn't become a single state for a very long time. And even then, it started off as a fairly loose kind of thing, which became a sort of centralized state.
Well, and so even now, some Italians will say they're still not very happy about it.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, we're going to remain in Turkey for part of our next discussion, but we're going to turn our attention to a story that is having an impact throughout the entire European continent, and that's the ongoing refugee crisis. Last November, Turkey struck a deal with the European Union to help stem the flow of refugees into Europe. But 2 months on, it seems the plan hasn't quite worked out as expected, leading Turkey and other European countries to add to these measures. Yesterday, Turkey announced its plan to offer Syrian refugees work permits in order to discourage them from crossing illegally into the EU. At the same time, Austria also announced it will take tougher action to turn away what it calls economic migrants as a way to reduce overall immigration. And Michael Binion, this happens at a moment where it seems that even those nations like Germany and Sweden that have been most supportive of the idea not just the idea, but the practice as well of refugees coming into Europe, are starting to have second thoughts.
And how? That is certainly true. Yes, in Germany, the situation is extremely serious for Merkel. She's got to do a pretty big U-turn all of a sudden without... Otherwise, she will find that she's been left high and dry by public opinion, which is outraged by these attacks on women in Cologne over New Year. Now, it isn't directly related, but it does turn out that most of the people attacking women, these mobs of men, were... migrants, people from the Middle East or beyond.
Although, interestingly, it seems that police believe they aren't part of the wave of refugees
indeed.
That have recently come in, but actually migrants who've been there maybe for quite some time.
Well, of course, it's very difficult to tell the German public these people were actually here 4 years instead of 6 months. You know, these people came 10 years ago. To them, they all seem the same, and they all seem part of the same culture. And that's the problem, that there's a feeling that we cannot assimilate this culture, and we can't assimilate these numbers so quickly and so many of them. And so there is a sort of backlash growing in Germany, which is already feeding into the already existing kind of anti-Muslim league, the Pegida group, who've been demonstrating against the Islamization of Germany, as they call it.
Not very successfully, though.
No,
I mean,
and
even
they've had
after
many
Cologne,
more people demonstrating, but yeah. The balance is tilting because of this. And I do think that the public opinion is becoming quite disenchanted with the policy of last year. And I think what Germany is going to have to do is close the door. And it is already beginning to do so, as is Sweden.
Well, Isabel, it's interesting when you look at this strange sort of domino effect. Sweden and Denmark are now reintroducing border controls. Denmark and Germany. Germany is now sending back more than 200 refugees a day to Austria. Austria is tightening its borders with Slovenia. We have this agreement between Turkey and the European Union where essentially the European Union is trying to say to Turkey, look, can you try and force them to stay as much as possible? It feels like we are bit by bit pushing everyone back to where they came from.
It's all pretty depressing, isn't it? And I think that yes, it's true that Merkel is in a slightly tougher spot, maybe considerably tougher spot now on this issue than she was last year. But, you know, Germany and Sweden have taken disproportionately huge numbers of refugees. Mm. And the essential problem is that nobody else stepped up. Mm. You know, everybody else has been sort of shuffling and looking at their feet. And
France
and, you know,
said they'd take 30,000. Germany took a million.
Indeed. And Britain?
Britain, 20,000 over 5 years.
Yeah, and none from actually the situation in Europe. But the problem with closing the borders, so of course, you know, Germany and Sweden come under this huge pressure. And in the end, everybody wants to go there. So, but this progressive closing of borders, where does that take you back to? It takes you back to Greece, you know, which can't cope. It's not going to stop people coming. It takes you to Turkey. It takes you to, you know, and new routes are being found, you know, up into Hungary, which of course is closed. Also closing its border. Now, you've got a couple of countries where you've got quite, well, two or three countries now where the political balance has shifted very far to the right, fed by this issue. And that is not going to help. It's not going to help Europe come to some more rational policy, which in the end, Europe is going to have to do because this is not going to go away.
On that issue, Michael, you know, that's the point, isn't it? People are going to come anyway. Whether there are 20-foot fences with machine guns all around Europe, people will try to come, they will still try to get in. And yet there is not a European-wide plan for how to deal with this. You have Germany with a million, you have Sweden with more than 130,000 last year. You've had then Italy and Greece, where there are hundreds of thousands collectively, and the scheme to resettle them from Italy and Greece so far... A few hundred have been moved from those countries to others.
Exactly. There was a piece I read today saying there's a big historical irony that for a whole century, well, more than a century, Europe populated the rest of the world. Europe sent out people to go and settle parts of Africa, well, all over the world. And now the rest of the world...
And we didn't
is
ask
trying
nicely
to,
about it either.
We didn't. We went there. And they didn't like it. And now the same is happening the other way around. The rest of the world wants to populate Europe. And I think in the end, Europe will actually become a much nastier place and a much less receptive place, simply because there is the feeling we cannot assimilate or will not assimilate so many people from other cultures. But the pressures will be there all the time. They won't stop. And people will come. And if those countries that have taken so many can make a supreme effort to integrate and settle them, they will benefit because they're short of labour. But if they don't, then there is going to be social tension.
But that is also, that's the other half of the Merkel argument. When she did open the doors, it was partly about, you know, wanting
Indeed.
To demonstrate humanity. It was also that Germany, like all of our countries, it's an old country.
Yep.
It needs labour. And there is a massive dividend to be won if Europe can be open to the right kind of migration and the right kind of migration.
But there's a social and cultural hurdle to overcome first.
Indeed there is, but, you know, whichever way you look at it, but the policy of closing the borders is actually worse. You know, where does that leave Europe in 20 years' time? It leaves it impoverished, you know, older and tired,
yeah.
With collapsing public services. You know, there is a very strong case to be made for inward migration, and Merkel was really the only person who was making it, and the rest of the political leadership in Europe has given way to the populist movements.
Michael, is there an argument that there are always social and cultural tensions surrounding immigration? You just need to look back at, you know, for example, the history of Britain, and whether you're looking at, you know, post-Second World War, when you had Windrush, before that, when you had the Irish, before that, you can go back 1,000 years if you want, and there were always issues of people coming with slightly different cultures, and how do you integrate them? Is there anything that makes you feel this is different from previous times?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And there have always been waves of immigration, and particularly into Britain, and Britain has benefited. Maybe the Danes came over in rather too many numbers when they came with the Viking ships.
And they were the Romans ever for us. Yeah.
That's right. But, I mean, that is the history of the settlement of various parts of Europe. People move, and they move across, and they move sometimes in great warlike numbers. It is a question of being able to integrate and absorb newcomers. And if, over time, it can be done, then it is often a very enriching experience. But it is a question of numbers and time. And as everything accelerates, we have neither.
Michael Binion, Isabel Hilton, thank you both. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
Meet the Writers is the show in which we have a chance to get intimate with some exciting authors. Airing at 1500 every Saturday and available as a podcast thereafter, it's an in-depth discussion about the life and work of a different writer every week, with me, Georgina Godwin, on Monocle 24.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in studio, Isabel Hilton and Michael Binion. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin has called for a new Syrian constitution as an essential first step, he says, to finding a political solution for the ongoing conflict. In an interview with the German newspaper Bild, he also said the regional crisis between Saudi Arabia and Iran would, quote, complicate the search for peace in Syria. Michael Binion, on the first point of a new Syrian constitution, how much of this is Mr. Putin sincerely trying to find a way through, and how much of it is a bit of game playing to allow his good friend Bashar al-Assad a bit more time in office?
Well, it's both. With Putin, you can never think that it's any one motive that's dominant. Clearly, Russian interest is the dominant motive. But I have to say, on this issue, I actually think that the Russians have had by far the most sensible policy, by far the best long-term vision. Nobody else has any long-term vision. His idea, which seems to me essentially correct, is this war will only ever end with political negotiation. You have to have everyone brought to the table. You're never going to get the government to go to a negotiation while it's losing. Therefore, you've got to stabilize the government as it is, then bring them to the negotiation. And then he's made it quite clear he will dump Assad.
On this point, you say, you know, the Syrian government won't come to the table unless they're winning.
Well, unless they're stable. Yes.
But then, you know, we've seen in the past that the rebels aren't too happy to come to the table.
No,
unless
they're not.
They're in a strong position.
Well, exactly. I mean, everybody is jockeying for their own position. You've got to get a kind of equilibrium, but you've got to push for some kind of negotiation. Now, what the Russians are now saying is all that we need to turn our attention to is defeating ISIS, because, of course, Russia is also threatened by that. They are, at the same time, of course, helping Assad to regain control of quite a lot of Syrian territory. But I do think their long-term plan is a negotiation, which is the only way this is ever going to end. He's also right that Saudi Arabia and Iran, that crisis, is completely complicating the whole issue.
Let's leave Saudi and Iran just to one side, because that could be a whole show on its own. In fact, actually, if you want to listen to a whole show, do listen to this week's Foreign Desk, which is about Saudi and Iran. But Isabel, on the point of is Putin right? Does he have the best plan, as Michael Binion has just suggested? Do you agree?
Well, I agree that, yes, there has to be a political settlement. We don't know what his constitutional proposals are. Certainly, Russia's acted with a certain clarity and decisiveness that we haven't seen in anybody else. And perhaps part of that is that they don't have a domestic constituency to answer to in quite the same way as the United States or NATO powers have. Whether that makes them right, I'm not sure.
Also, Michael, this issue about, you know, that Putin will keep on banging on about, that, you know, the important thing is to defeat ISIS, it completely ignores the fact that Assad is not only killing more of his own citizens than ISIS are, but also that Assad has actually been quite happy for ISIS to take certain parts of the country and to fight other rebels.
I mean, in a way, has been the one thing that he's used to hold many Syrians to his side by pointing out how terrible the atrocities are that ISIS have committed, particularly against minorities. So Christians, almost to a man, now back Assad, and other minorities. Syria is made up of minorities. I mean, certainly Assad is as exploitative and certainly as barbaric as anyone else in Syria, possibly you might say more so in that he began it. Mm. But the fact is that it's got to end in some kind of negotiation or deal. The idea of partitioning Syria is frankly a non-starter.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there and move on to our final story of the night and the world of cinema. More specifically, China's Hollywood aspirations. After weeks of rumours about a possible deal, it's been confirmed that China's Dalian Wonder Group is to buy a stake in the Hollywood film studio Legendary Entertainment. The deal valued at $3.5 billion, £2.4 billion if you prefer it that way, was announced earlier today by both firms at a press conference in Beijing. Isabel, we've certainly seen over the last few years that Hollywood has been chasing after the Chinese yuan. There's been lots of action films that have, for some reason, had scenes in Shanghai,
in China, yeah.
Or you know, or in Hong Kong or elsewhere. Do you think we're going to be seeing more of these?
Sure, and I think that of all the studios for a Chinese company to take over, this is probably the least complicated one. I mean, you know, big monster movies, action movies, that kind of thing. You don't have political complications. Although there was the Panda Kung Fu movie, which had a bit of a backlash in China because the panda had blue eyes, and this became a source of some tension. But Hollywood has also been accused, even more serious studios, if you like, have been accused of pandering to Chinese censorship in order to get into the Chinese market, and it is a vast and still growing market. So you've got the appeal from the Hollywood perspective. You've also got the appeal from the China perspective, because China, there's a lot of hot money looking for a safer investment. China, you know, wants to be a big soft power. So it's a good marriage in that sense. More intriguing in some ways is the purchase of Grindr, the gay dating website, by a Chinese gaming company, Beijing Kunlun. Perhaps less of a cultural fit there, but we'll see.
Okay, well, we'll see about that one. Michael Binion, on both these cases, is part of this about, as Isabel says, the fact that there is a lot of money in China that a lot of people in China think might be a little bit safer somewhere else?
Yes, partly, but I also think it's because lifestyle is probably one of the most profitable investments in the future. So-called entertainment, lifestyle, whatever you might say, both these things, in a way, you could say Grindr, I mean, it's a slightly off the end of the scale lifestyle purchase, but films more mainstream and much larger, but it's clearly an area where a lot of people will put a lot of money in the future, and it's a good thing to get into for them.
Although, if someone had said the same thing about the music industry 10 or 15 years ago, they might not be sort of looking at a big pile of money these days. Isabel, if, let's say, and this is going to be very, very brief, so we're going to have to wrap up very quickly. If there was to be a great Chinese film industry that was a bit more creative, a bit more dynamic, a bit more political, perhaps, do you think it could that could take place soon?
I think things are moving slightly in the other direction in China. I think we're likely to see more spectacle, more kind of think Beijing. I mean, if one of the great fifth generation film directors ended up directing the Beijing Olympics opening show, Empty Splendor.
There we are. We'll leave it there. Isabel Hilton, Michael Binion, thank you both very much indeed. Midori House was produced by Carlos Ribello, researched by Guy Lutz, Jolene Goffin and Ada McLaughlin. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We're back the same time tomorrow. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Goodbye.